Doris Lessing, The Cleft, 2007. A Roman scholar of the age of Nero has a mysterious manuscript from ancient times, times that he considers ancestral to his world, though they differ strangely from Roman, or even human, history and myth. The Cleft is his translation of this document, with his comments and occasionally a modest bit of autobiography. Somewhere, sometime, creatures like a cross between women and walruses, called clefts, heaved about on a seashore and had babies. They conceived by an unspecified mechanism of parthenogenesis, since there were no males. They did nothing but wallow, give birth, suckle, and occasionally sacrifice a young female by pushing her off a high rock, also called the cleft. It was an idyllic life. But suddenly, somehow, one of the females had a baby with a spigot rather than a cleft. Ruled by unthinking instinct as they were, the walrus women were upset. As more of them bore such monsters, they dimly perceived that trouble lay ahead, change, progress, even perhaps the dawn of something like, although not awfully like, intelligence. They tried discarding their male infants and mutilating them, and so on, but they kept having them, and large eagles kept carrying the babies off and depositing them safely in a valley just over the hill. There some eventually survived, nourished by a single extremely patient and highly lactiferous doe. After a while these males grew up, and a female who went over the hill found them and discovered sex. Just sex. Nothing in the story so far has indicated that these creatures know love, affection, or friendship, or have any community feeling more developed than that of a school of fish. And, as in other speculative fiction by Doris Lessing, free will is not an option. People do not choose or decide anything, but are driven by imperative, ineluctable orders from nature or God or some people from another planet. Thus impelled, and having become slenderer and more terrestrial, the young cleft women desert the hideous fat old walrus women and start keeping house for the men. Of course, they go on having babies. The men neither keep house nor have babies, but do brave and adventurous things. Eventually, the passage of time is deliberately vague. Some men, led by a man named Horsa, set off by raft and coracle to explore beyond their world island. Since the unruly mob of little boys that tag after them is on foot, the men of the fleet hug the shore, landing every night to be with the boys and some young women who have also come along for sex. Why they use boats at all is unclear, but at last they sight a farther shore, and Horsa sets sail for it with a single companion and is thrown back by a storm. The whole exploring party then blunders its way overland back to the original colony. There, some of the young men, for no particular reason, destroy the great rock called the Cleft, and Horsa and the leader of the women, Marona, move the colony up the coast, and so the story ends. There are a few other names, Mare, Astra, and Maeve, as puzzlingly Celtic as Horsa is puzzlingly Anglo-Saxon. But there are no characters. The author scrupulously refrains from anything characteristic at all. Description is in the most resolutely general terms. The climate is warm. The landscape has trees, caves. There are wild animals. Nothing vivid. No details. Perhaps Doris Lessing believes inexactness is typical of myth, or that lack of local color gives a parable more universal applicability. I can only disagree, as I find the power of myth often lies in its startling immediacy, and follow Blake in believing that all sublimity is founded on minute discrimination. I call the tale a parable, but hesitantly, because I can't believe it says what I think it says. It appears to be as prescriptive as Desmond Morris and more essentialist than Freud himself. Anatomy is destiny. Gender is an absolute binary. Women are passive, incurious, timid, and instinctively nurturant. Without men, they scarcely rise above animal mindlessness. Men are intellectual, inventive, daring, rash, independent, and need women only to relieve libido and breed more men. Men achieve, women nag. Much of the presentation of this is familiar from the literature of misogyny. The old she's are described, vividly for once, with loathing and disgust. The escapades of boys are made much of, the doings of girl children are ignored. Now this, of course, may be supposed to be the voice of the Roman scholar, who seems a decent fellow in his autobiographical musings, but who is, after all, retelling the story from a man's viewpoint. He's aware of that, and often speaks of it. Yet where does that leave us? It merely makes it impossible to read the text either as irony or as satire. There are some strange omissions. Our Roman would wonder at men who never fought, showed no signs of being warriors, and kept no discipline over their sons, all very unmanly for Roman standards. Living in the days of Greek influence, he might also have wondered why homosexuality is mentioned only as a temporary expedient for boys without access to women. If we are offered the story as an origin myth of human sexuality and gender, it is unacceptable. It is incomplete. It is deeply arbitrary. I'd be happy to be shown that I misunderstood it, for as it is, I see in it little but a reworking of a tiresome science fiction cliché. A hive of mindless females is awakened and elevated, to the low degree of which the female is capable, by the wondrous shock of masculinity. A tale of sleeping beauties. Only they aren't beautiful. There are a lot of slobbering walruses till the prince comes along.